Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I've been doing a ton of stuff lately, mostly online, that is, of very different kinds of materials, and I wanted to let you know about them. But first, I want to remind everybody who wonders if this is live or not. This is live on January 9th, 2019. And that means you can call in if you're listening to it live. And you'll probably be listening on PRN.FM, maybe on some other source. You can call in live and ask questions, and we're going to have a very, very interesting guest today. By the way, Michael, have you arrived? Are you all hooked up?
I am here, Peter. Yes, I am.
Oh, you sound good. You sound wonderful. Well, the call-in, as always, is 888-874-4888. And remember, I have the dedicated email, breganlive@hotmail.com. That's just breganlive@hotmail.com. And you can just, you know, email me questions. I set it up just for the radio show, things you want me to talk about, commentary. And we also have a breaking news that goes on every day on the website. And on some occasions, we'll have materials that I bring up during my discussions on the air with you. And also, we have a searchable archive going back over hundreds of shows for Bregan.com. And meanwhile, let me tell you just some of what I've been doing right now. All of it is up on the website. First of all, we're really encouraging people to go see the film. It's free. It's called The Minds of Men. You can go watch it on YouTube. Make a contribution if you can, if you feel like it. Almost a million people now have watched The Minds of Men, and it features me. It's got about four segments, and I come in a lot on the third and the fourth segment. In someplace on the internet, the producers, the filmmakers describe it as starring me, or which I think is the first time I've ever seen anybody say that about a film. And also of real interest, and by the way, on YouTube, that's getting to be about 700,000 in a relatively short time. That's a lot of people. And we've also just put up the whole unedited interview that was done of me for The Minds of Men. It's over an hour, but it's in eight parts. Most of it has not gone up onto the full-length documentary, really a long documentary film. So you can see a lot of stuff that didn't make it there. And it's a very genuine interview by me because I really was enjoying Aaron and Michelle Dykes, who were the filmmakers for this terrific film. And they just connected with me, and I connected with them. And I really talked from the heart about what it was like to stand up to the federal government on their, what now we would call mind control, behavioral control through psychosurgery, where they were actually funding psychosurgery and where psychosurgeons were claiming it was going to be an answer to, believe it or not, ghetto riots. It's very racist that they thought the leaders of the ghetto riots in the 60s and the 70s had brain disease and could be operated on. And they talked about bomb throwers, and they got special funding from Congress and the Justice Department. And I stopped psychosurgery around most of the world, and just took several years out of my life. It was before Ginger, and it's an accomplishment which is pretty much avoided. No one's really wanted to write about it, you know, who's in the medical community or the scientific community, but it's just an amazing thing. And you'll see me talking about this in retrospect now, about what I went through doing it, how I felt about doing it. And I'd love for you to watch that interview. Part one is up. And we'll eventually be, you know, we're going to try to get one a week up, and then we'll put up the whole thing. But I'm very excited about getting that up on the air. Now, in contrast to, and I also have been working on putting together a new section on the front page that you can get to called Psychiatry as an Instrument of Social and Political Control. We are putting it together in a much better way than the similar materials were. And part of it is about psychosurgery, and then a part of it goes to the 1990s when Ginger and I stopped something called the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, a huge amount of time and energy, and led by Ginger to a great deal, and resulted in the book, The War Against Children, which we reprinted and was later named A War Against Children of Color, which is what it really was. It was eugenical and racist in nature. They were going to go into the inner cities and find out what was the matter with little black children starting in the womb, that they grew up to be violent. They weren't looking at racism, economics, unemployment, broken families, misguided political philosophies, none of that. They were going to look for the genetics. Horrible, very racist, very Nazi Germany-like, and I don't use that word lightly. And also on that section, on the psychiatry as an instrument of social and political control, there is material about the role of psychiatry in Nazi Germany and a little bit about my role in blowing the whistle on it and actually being the invited scientist at a big conference in Germany to talk about the murder of mental patients by the Germans. So it's a very interesting section now, and you'll find it as psychiatry as the instrument of social and political control. So I've been very, very busy on the website, just putting up interesting things, wanting to just increase the traffic there, which is now in the several thousands of visits, maintaining really over the summer at the several thousand visits, and now gaining a day and 10, 15,000 visits, and now gaining again. So that's just a lot of stuff going on, and I think you'll enjoy what's up on the YouTube. Now, separate from that, in a whole different vein, I've been really busy lately, just intellectually. I have two very interesting blogs up. One went up a few weeks ago, and one went up yesterday. You can get to them by going to the Frequent Alerts, which I hope all of you belong to by now. It's free, and sign up, and you'll get it in the email, but you can also in your email. But you can also go to the website and just check them out for free. And we may end up talking about these today. One of the blogs is called "Are Emotional Disorders Really Disorders of Love?" And of course, people rightfully criticized my calling the emotional issues, the love issues, disorders. But I was trying to make a point there about put it in the face of psychiatry, or everything they're calling disorders, is really about relationship. It's about attachment, I think. It's about love, at least most of them. And now I've put up a blog, How Love Can Reformat Our Lives. So today, with my guest, one might think, how are we going to be what are we going to be talking about today with a classical professor about all of these issues? Michael Fontaine is a dear friend of mine. I really am very fond of Michael. He's one of the most interesting people I ever talked to or I ever have on the show. And you've heard him before talking about classical literature. classical living, classical lives. And he also was working with the student body at Cornell. I don't want to get too involved with, you know, with his work, but he's doing good things, trying to humanize the undergraduate academics at Cornell. He's just a good man, and God, does he know stuff. Michael, hi.
How are you, Peter? It's nice to hear from you again.
I'm a little breathless since I saw you a couple of days ago. and I continue to be a little breathless with all that goes on and all that we're doing. And I want to remind you folks, you can call in. And you can do that at 888-874-4888. And I think Michael's had a chance to look at the two love blogs I wrote. And what I want to talk about with Michael is basically anything he wants to. But in particular, Michael, we want to talk about what do we learn in the past from more ancient classical times about love, about homosexuality, about attitudes toward men and women and sex that can inform us today. So there's a huge topic for you.
Yeah, it is. It's really wonderful to talk to you again. And the topic is endless, and it's endlessly fascinating. Maybe it would help if I remind the audience what classics is the fancy name that refers to the study of ancient Greece and the ancient Roman Empire. And just to orient you in history, the high point of Greece was 2,500 years ago. And the high point of Rome was about 2,000 years ago, right around the time Jesus was born. And so we're talking about a very, very long time ago. But we have a ton of literature from the time period. We have a ton of archaeology, art history, all sorts of things. So we know a lot about those two societies. And I want to maybe pick up with maybe the last thing you said. It made me think of something that I hadn't thought to bring up in this context. But love today is very much... as you talk about in the latest blog, you know, two people find each other and it completes their lives. One of the things that's sort of most interesting about classical Athens, Athens is the capital of Greece, you know, 2,500 years ago, is that men and women in their society were by and large segregated from each other, among the, what we would call the middle and the upper classes. And so as a consequence of that, men and women had very, very little access to each other. And so the marriages were in Athens were arranged, as they are still in some societies today. But young men and young women, right around the time the hormones are just going bananas in their adolescence, they didn't really have much opportunity to see each other. And so maybe it's connected, maybe it's independent, but a lot of your audience will know that in Athens, the men in particular had homosexual relationships alongside their heterosexual relationships. And so a man, a free man, would be married typically, but would also have a younger boyfriend. So a young man around the age of 15, 14, something like that. And so what's really quite striking is that courtship rituals, the kind we're all familiar with from Romeo and Juliet, or some of the things you kind of talk about really in your blog, you know, the bringing of flowers, writing love poetry, singing songs. Those rituals, as we know them, mostly descend from those homosexual relationships in Athens, not the heterosexual ones. Isn't that interesting?
Well, it's extremely interesting, and it's something I know only a little about. And I thought that a lot of those relationships between the men and the boys were actually even younger children. Is that a mistake on my part, that they really were, you know, basically child abuse?
Well, this is where we've got to be pretty careful in distinguishing. So what the Greeks called pederasty was different from what some people call pedophilia. Now, both of those words mean loving children. But pedophilia, as we use the term today, tends to mean quite young children. And it is considered a crime, as far as I know, everywhere. Pederasty was a slightly different thing. So you'd be it's certainly illegal in the United States, and I believe it's illegal many places, but not necessarily everywhere. it would be a man in his 20s, perhaps 30s, would be the older member of that relationship. And then the younger member would be around the age of 13, 14, maybe 15. And then as soon as the hair on his face began to show in the formation of a beard is when that relationship would typically cease, at least in its erotic component. And so some people draw a big distinction there, others don't, but I do want to make sure that I mention that.
Yeah, and that's helping me, you're teaching me, and I'm sure teaching the audience, and we're into an area I hadn't expected to go into a lot. We talked a little bit about it before the show, and it's very, very interesting. Was there love literature about these older, younger men or boys?
Yes, there is. There's some. There's also a tremendous amount of love literature, especially in Rome, between men and women. So we do see these things start to surface. But Sappho, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Sappho, was the most famous poetess. She's the most famous woman poet of the ancient world. She was from the island of Lesbos, which is part of Greece. It's just off the coast of Turkey today. And because she was from Lesbos, we get the word lesbian, because she wrote love poetry not to her husband but to another woman. And so she is the sort of archetypal, the original template from which all other lesbians are named. And unfortunately, we don't really know much at all about lesbian relationships, very little, but they certainly existed, and that we know. I do, if you don't mind me switching a bit, though, I wanted to think a little bit about your essay, because I found it very, very moving. It made me think very much about my own relationships in the past and some of the ones I have today. But
and this is the essay, just to let people know. This is the one that just came out yesterday, How Love Can Reformat Our Lives. Yeah, go ahead.
Excellent. So the audience can read this now if they want to go ahead and have a look. Is that right? It's
yeah,
available?
Absolutely.
Terrific. Well, and so it's, as I read it at first, I think I may have told you my initial reaction. I said, this is like a Hollywood script. It's so beautiful. It's so moving. This is exactly what you know, many of us dream will happen in our lives. You're smitten with love, and then you have an incredible experience. In many cases in the ancient world, though, they characterized love quite differently. And in the psychiatric context of today, I think this is going to surprise you. Many of them regarded love as an illness. The poets in particular call it an illness, and today you would probably call it a mental illness. And there's a couple reasons for this, right? So when you fall in love, or when you, let's say you are, I don't know, a teenager, and you look across the room, maybe the dance floor, and you see this absolutely beautiful person, and what happens? Well, you start feeling your temperature rise. You know, sweat might break out on your forehead. You try and talk, and nothing really good is coming out, and you... So there are physical reactions to this infatuation or this feeling of, the flushing and the infatuation that you see when you see someone you're attracted to. And there's a couple of accidents of language in Greek and Latin, which were the two languages they spoke back then, that sort of connected the two even more. So the word, for example, for the Greek goddess of love is Aphrodite. Now, that word Aphrodite, her name, sounds very similar to one of the Greek words for a madman or for insanity, which is Aphrosune. And the poets connect these two quite a bit, and they say, well, Aphrodite has driven me she's given me Aphrosune. She's made me crazy. And the same thing happens in Latin for the word a young man in love is amans, but a crazy person is amens, someone who is demented. And so they say a young man, what does he do when he falls in love? He starts acting like someone differently, starts to shun his family, maybe do things he wouldn't normally do. Same, of course, for young women. And so they say a young person in love, today you would say they're crazy. Which is, I think, about as different from what you're getting at, and I think you're correct in your characterization in the essay, that love is the way out of feeling isolated and forlorn and like no one cares.
Well, so that's very interesting. And in fact, the theme of love and madness runs into modern psychology. William James, who was writing at the turn of the century, a century ago, great two-volume thing, set I found cheap as a college student and bought and read on my own. James is a very thoughtful human being. He had deep respect for religious experience and passionate religious experience. And he was also a practical psychologist. But in regard to love, he thought it was a monomania. He thought that romantic love was craziness. And Freud defines basically, I think, looked at romantic love both in his life and certainly in his writings as kind of a narcissistic projection where, you give literally excessive value to another human being based on your own narcissism. So this theme really goes into the modern literature. And the other thing I notice about literature that does talk about caring, they tend not to call it love, and I've been just deciding more and more it's just got to be called love. For example, there's a marvelous whole psychological literature on what's called attachment theory, and it's ultimately about the various kinds of love people feel, including the early love between an infant and its mother. But they won't use the word attachment because they want to be, love, they want to look scientific, I guess. And they call it attachment. And I think we need to be looking more and more at love itself, this tremendous sense of joy and happiness that we can receive from having a relationship with another human being, whether it's gay or straight. I do not think there is much, if any, difference at all in my own experience with the gay people I know. I don't see any difference at all, actually. This has been a struggle throughout time as to whether love is madness or not. Go ahead.
Well, no, you make me think of a lot of things. I agree with you that the term attachment rather than love between a parent and a child is sort of kind of strange. And it's sort of bizarre, to be honest. It sounds like adhesive tape or something when you call it.
Well, they were trained originally as psychoanalysts, and so rigid was psychoanalyst analysis at the time that they, I think, thought attachment was too romantic, probably, because they were so dry. And this is the problem. So much of the psychology written by objectifying males trying to understand life. But let me again, I want to hear more from you. You have so much new to tell us.
Oh, there's the ancients wondered quite a bit about where love comes from or what it actually is. I mentioned Aphrodite already. She's the goddess of love. And the Greeks had this idea, the same, the Romans as well. They shared the same goddess. They called her Venus. It gives you words, I hate to say it, like venereal disease. That's where the word comes from. But, the idea was to externalize love as a force. That's not in you, and it's not in me, and it's not in the object of our affection or the other person, but it's somehow, it comes from outside of us, somewhere in the universe. And the usual belief is that it was the most powerful force in the whole universe, more powerful than even the greatest of the gods, which was Zeus for the Greeks or Jupiter for the Romans. So they said even Jupiter or even Zeus himself is subject to love. And so when he sees another person, usually a woman, sometimes a boy, he can't help himself and he has to run off and chase that person. And so, I read these texts sometimes with students at Cornell, and sometimes they snicker or they turn up their noses. And then I turn the question. I say, what is your explanation for love? Where do you think it comes from? And I don't know that we have a really good answer for that at this point. Is it coming from within us? Is it coming from outside of us? Is it today, I think all of our explanations are genetic, aren't they? That we all feel scientific when we say, well, such and such is genetic, or it's coming from our biology because we're all made up of lumpy masses of chemicals and that sort of thing. But I'm not sure that's really the answer. And so one of the most famous Greek authors of all time was the philosopher Plato. And your audience will know Plato as the source of the name Platonic love. Which is a little ironic given what I'm about to tell you. But Plato was, he lived in Athens in the very end of the 5th century, and then he became active in the beginning of the 4th century BCE. So this is in the 390s and the 380s and the 370s BC. Plato opened a school to attract students and discuss philosophy. He called it the Academy, which is where we get the word ourselves. And in that connection, he wrote a dialogue, sort of a meditation with fictional characters called Symposium. And the Symposium is a Greek word, again, it means a drinking party, and that's the fictitious setting of...
I never heard that in my courses in college.
I know. We do Symposia all wrong. We should be doing it their way. The Symposium was a party, and it's quite interesting all by itself, typically among just men. It was part of their men and younger boys. This was part of their acculturation ritual in Athens. So the women were typically obligated to stay upstairs in what the Greeks call the women's quarters of the house. And the men had a special room, which in English would be called something like the man cave, the andreion. And they would sit around in certain numbers and in certain groupings, and they would drink wine in large quantities, and they would discuss philosophy or life or whatever. They would hear entertainment. And so Plato took this actual institution, the Symposium, and he made it the background for this dialogue, the Symposium. And when the dialogue begins, they decide they're going to discuss, everybody there is going to discuss the question, what is love? And so that becomes the main theme of the dialogue. And so everybody at this symposium has to take turns giving a speech on what is love, where does it come from, and this sort of thing. And so there are, if my memory serves, 7 or 8 speeches. I may not be remembering it exactly right. Some of them are serious, some are not so serious, but everybody's got a different take, and nobody has any idea what it actually is. But I thought I'd tell you maybe the most famous one of all. One of the characters at this dialogue is the comedian Aristophanes. It would be like having, I don't know, Trevor Noah or Jon Stewart or one of these famous television comedians be there. And so when it comes time for him to make a speech, he says, I'm going to talk about the origins of love, where it comes from. And so Aristophanes says, let me tell you a little story. Once upon a time, a very long time ago, people were shaped differently than the way we are today. Back then, everybody had 4 hands, and they had 4 legs. They had 2 faces, which faced outward on each side. And they had 4 ears, and they had 2 sets of genitals, and onward and onward. So everything was doubled. And so they were all getting along and living life, and they decided they became proud in time, and they thought that they could threaten heaven and wage war with the gods. So Zeus decided to intervene by picking the people up and getting a thread and slicing each of these people in half. And after he'd sliced each of these people in half, he had another god, the god of the forge, Hephaestus, turn the heads back around the other way and turn the genitals back around the other way. And so what resulted were half people who looked like men and women today. But for all their lives, they were lonely and unhappy because they were always seeking to find their other missing half. And so, according to Aristophanes, that's why people search their whole lives for their soulmate. And it explains why when they do find that person, they do everything they can to thrust their bodies together and try and join together as if they were sewing themselves back up the way they once were.
I love it.
Unbelievable.
And so, but it certainly explains the passion.
It does. And the passion is pretty difficult to explain. I mean, we see it in the animals for sure. And we see it in us, and a lot of us like to think we're better than animals, and we hope it's not just that. But this attraction, you know, we say it's magnetic. They had the same metaphor that we do. It's just like magnets being drawn together and that sort of thing. And so with a speech like this, for example, it's hard to know what the philosopher was doing. Was he just sort of trolling everybody, making us laugh by having a comedian say this? Or is it possible he actually thought this is the way life once was? I mean, there's not the slightest evidence it was ever really like that, but it certainly makes you think.
You know, there's a movie, I can't remember the name of it, but I think there was a movie that was fairly charming, and the concept in the movie was of split-aparts, that you have to find your split-apart, and that's the sounds like the exact origin goes back a long ways.
It may well be. I think certainly creative artists have gone back to the story a few times, and if the audience goes on YouTube, they can find some creative reenactments of this particular speech. It does seem to be the origin of the soulmate, the idea that your soul is trying to join together with the soul of someone else out there. When you find the right person for you, you want to spend your entire life with that person. And we have people say these things today, right? That so-and-so completes me. You hear this in wedding vows.
How far back could you trace that particular idea? You said that, you know, with the separation of men and women in the classical times, when do we get an idea coming up of the romantic love, the finding your soulmate, your split apart, the one and only, the person who completes you? When does that begin to show up?
Well, I do think probably we see it in that dialogue right there.
In that dialogue, yeah, but sure. When in the more culture, definitely, but more in the cultural life is what I meant. I'm actually thinking this through for the, you know, I've never thought this in depth because I didn't have as much information before as you're providing. But when does it begin to show up in literature other than that, or in life, the actual life in the communities?
Yeah, it's tougher to say with the life in the community. I'm trying to think of any kind of inscriptions or vase paintings or something that would help me understand that. There are lots and lots and lots of painted Greek vases. It's not really my expertise, so I don't know if we if you find that kind of a language. We definitely do see all sorts of risque behavior and sexuality and seductions on those vases. But the idea of pure complementary love, boy, I hate to say, but maybe it comes out of Plato. But I do want to take your question a little bit differently. Athens in the 5th century is the society that we know the most about. But if you go further back in Greek time, it brings your brings us back to, say, the around the year 700 BCE. It gets us to the second of the two great epics written in ancient Greece. The first is the Iliad, and the second is the Odyssey, the one that the Honda minivan is named for. And you're going to like this because it's the story of the hero Odysseus in this epic poem. He's got to get back to his home, and his home is an island called Ithaca.
By the way, I actually read this stuff in college. I must have had a course. I can't even remember what it was, but go ahead.
Yes, I mean, it is the Iliad is good, but the Odyssey is routinely ranked as one of the top 10 greatest stories ever told, which is remarkable considering it's probably about 2,700 years old at this point. And it's the story, I can refresh your memory a bit, a man named Odysseus has gone off to war, in a huge war on the scale back then of a World War II, something like that. He's been shipped abroad against his will. He didn't want to go. He spends 10 years at the war. When the war is over, everybody else, they're demobbed, and they are, they all go back to their homelands in Greece and back to their families after 10 years. But this guy, Odysseus, through a series of adventures, he doesn't get back to his own homeland for another 10 years. So he's away from his home for 20 years. And his goal in getting back home is to see his wife, who Homer always calls the faithful Penelope. She's the queen of his little rocky island. And so it's a love story all the way through, from the beginning to the end. It's not quite a love story in the Hollywood sense, though, because Odysseus sleeps with a number of other women along the way. There doesn't seem to be any expectation that he'll be faithful toward his own wife. There very much is the expectation that she will be faithful. And while he is away, there are a number of suitors move into his house. And these are little petty chieftains from the nearby villages or the local islands. And they say, oh, your husband's dead. He's been gone for 20 years. This is ridiculous. You need to marry one of us so we can heal the community and have proper governance and this sort of thing. And so the suitors have moved into his house, and they're all taking turns trying to woo and impress Penelope. And she very cunningly, she staves them off by saying that she has to weave a burial shroud for her father-in-law. So every day she weaves at her loom to create this thing. And then every night when everyone's gone to sleep, she pulls all the threads back out. So she gets back to her starting point. And that's what the epic is about, is all about Odysseus trying to get back home to his wife Penelope. And I was thinking about all this earlier when I was reading your essay, in a very strange way, believe it or not. So the story is extremely romantic. It's beautiful when Odysseus gets back and he and Penelope reunite. And there's sort of a second marriage that takes place, and they go off to the bedroom together and they say, you know, we squandered our youth being apart. But most readers, in my experience, don't find that the most poignant part of the story. I want to read you something. That
is it. Is it the dog?
It's the dog. It's
the dog. I remember that as the most poignant part of the story.
Very good. Yes. And so I thought about this because I was reading you. Let me read you what you wrote in your essay. I highlighted a part here. You say love as joyful awareness is perhaps nowhere more fervently and beautifully expressed than in art forms such as drama, poetry, hymns, and gospel singing. Art as an expression of love is perhaps unexcelled, except perhaps for the joyous cacophony of barking and howling with which our three dogs greeted my wife Ginger today on her return home after only 2 hours' absence. Now, everyone who loves dogs, every pet lover knows exactly what you're talking about. It's just fantastic to come home to that sort of thing. And this is what happens. I'm glad you remembered it because it is one of the most memorable moments. So Odysseus, when he gets back home to his island, he arrives and there are all these suitors that have taken over his palace and they're a threat. They're going to try and kill his son and they know that if he ever comes back, they're going to kill him too. So he's got to come back in disguise and he disguises himself as a beggar and he doesn't go straight back to the palace and ring the doorbell and say, I'm home. He knows it'll be the end of him. So he goes to his swineherd's hut and he gets out there and the swineherd has remained loyal to him all this time and Odysseus is dressed up as a beggar. And I thought I'd read this in a brand new translation that has really taken the literary world by storm. It's by a professor named Emily Wilson at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a spectacularly gifted translator. And this translation was on bestseller charts last year. So Odysseus is dressed as this beggar, and the swineherd is leading him through his estate. So here I'm going to start the reading. It says, as they spoke, Argos, the dog that lay there, raised his head and ears. Odysseus had trained this dog, but with no benefit. He left too soon to march on holy Troy. That's where he went off to fight the war. The master gone, boys took the puppy out to hunt wild goats and deer and hares. But now the dog lay neglected, without an owner, in a pile of dung from mules and cows. So Argos lay there dirty, covered with fleas. And when he realized Odysseus was near, he wagged his tail, and both his ears dropped back. He was too weak to move towards his master. At a distance, Odysseus had noticed, and he wiped his tears away and hid them easily. And he says, you might, to the swineherd, he says, it's strange this dog is lying in the dung. He looks so handsome, though it's hard to tell if he can run or if he's a pet, a table dog, kept just for looks. And the swineherd replied, well, this dog belonged to someone who's died in foreign lands. If he were in good health, as when Odysseus abandoned him and went to Troy, you would soon see how quick and brave he used to be. He went to hunt in woodland, and he always caught his prey. His nose was marvelous, but now he's in bad condition with his master gone, long dead. And then he says nobody's caring for it. And with that, the swineherd went inside the palace to join the suitors. And then Homer says, 20 years had passed since Argos saw Odysseus, and now he saw him for the final time. Then suddenly, black death took hold of him. And it's just so moving. The dog can see right through the disguise. People burst into tears when they read this. It's so moving. because dogs love us unconditionally. And so I was going to ask you, why is that so hard for us human beings? Why can't we have these kind of relationships with people?
Well, I try to talk about that in both of my my blogs. Eventually, that's the theme, is what goes on with us. But, you know, I had a different memory of a different story, which is that the dog is on the balcony and is so excited to see his return of his master that he falls from it and dies. Is that a story you've ever heard?
It's not this story, but it certainly sounds connected. I wonder, it's not sparking a memory from Greek literature, but that doesn't mean it's not out there or in some other tradition.
In my mind, it is so much with Odysseus coming back that I thought that's the story you were going to tell. So goodness knows where my mind went. Talk about false memory syndrome.
Yeah. But you know, the point is the same, that the dog has waited his whole life to see his master, and he sees right through the beggar disguise. You can't fool a dog.
Yeah. And his return was very violent, too. I don't think we should leave that out. Didn't he kill a lot of people, slay all these suitors?
He killed every single one of them. It's terrible. Yeah. Not just the suitors. He also killed all of the slaves that he regarded as disloyal. So this is interesting. A lot of people have been talking about that. This new translation really foregrounds the slavery and some of Odysseus's extremely challenging actions. And, you know, it depends to what extent you want to regard the epic as realistic or all just fairy tale. But he kills about 100, I think it's 109 suitors. He and his son Telemachus shoot them all with arrows. And then they break the necks of the slaves who had served the suitors rather than waiting for him. In fact, that's the very end of the Odyssey. A lot of people think that the Odyssey ends when Penelope and Odysseus go off into the bedroom together and they have this sort of ceremonial reunification. But in fact, the epic goes for a little bit longer. What happens is the parents of all those suitors that have just been killed, they come over to the island and they say, this is outrageous. You can't just kill these people. And so the epic threatens to keep going and going and going. And then suddenly Athena throws Zeus or Athena throws a lightning bolt, puts a stop to the entire thing and says, nope, no more. It's all over. Everybody go back home. So a lot of people don't really like the ending at that point. But you're quite right that it's the homecoming is not easy.
Golly, I'll have to try to, I suppose I could Google, but I don't want to Google anything while I'm on the radio with you. But this is all very fascinating. You raised the question of why is it so difficult for us? And, you know, it is. It's always been difficult. And every story going back talks about the difficulties. But usually in the older stories, I'm beginning to think the difficulty is other people interfering. How old is the story of Romeo and Juliet? I know most of Shakespeare's stories he borrowed, right? So
you're quite right. So
how old is Romeo and Juliet? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, that'd be about 500 years ago, I think. If I'm not getting my boy, no, that's taking us too far back.
I thought it was originally a story in older times in Italy or something else.
You're exactly right. So the story itself comes from an epic poem called The Metamorphoses of Ovid. And a lot of people, a lot of your audience, this is another book that you read in college or you read in adaptations for kids all the time. So the original story is set in, I believe, what would be Iraq today? And it involves a young man and a young woman, Pyramus and Thisbe. And
I actually wrote a little play, unpublished, obviously, about that. This is getting me into a whole era of my life I've forgotten. Go ahead.
So you know the story, and this is, you know, I really...
Tell the story, and I'm vague even in my memory, even though somewhere in my files in some basement is a play I wrote about this. But go ahead and tell the story.
Well, I hope you can find it. The story is, in rough outlines, virtually the same as what Shakespeare told. His is set in Verona, Italy. This is set, as I say, if I have the memory right, I believe it's sort of in Babylon. I might be off a little bit.
I was thinking North Africa, but that doesn't make much sense. Go ahead.
That's possible. This was all part of the Greco-Roman world at that time, so it's quite possible. But they live next door to each other, and their houses share a wall. And, you know, they have no access to each other in this culture. And so what do? They're clever. They drill a hole in the wall, and they pass notes back and forth. And the families don't want them to get together. So they decide they're going to conspire and meet up at a secret spot. And what is it? Let's see if I get this right. Thisbe goes first, and she gets there, and the veil falls from her head, and a mountain lion comes nearby and sort of worries, you know, chews the whole thing up and leaves it there, and then runs off. And so Pyramus gets there, and he thinks that she's been mauled to death by this mountain lion. So he decides to stab himself and commit suicide because he doesn't want to live without her. And so he takes out his dagger and he stabs himself in the chest, and Ovid rather comically says that it's the same as when a pipe bursts in your house and the blood goes spewing up into the air. And it makes people laugh, but it's an edible, it's sort of an explanation story for why mulberries are red. Because the blood shoots up into the air and hits the branches and dyes these berries red. And so just as he is dying and he's beyond the point where there any kind of recovery is possible, Thisbe comes back and sees him and joins him by committing suicide as well. So this is exactly the story that Shakespeare must have been reading when he decided to write Romeo.
Let me go back, because we are a very psychologically oriented group, I would think, a lot of us listening to the show. I do try to address in this, in my blogs, you know, what happens to people that they just so run from something that can be so amazing. And I tell the story of me and Ginger meeting in 1972, which in the past I've only told to dear friends. And I give the basic outlines of the story and how close we felt. We met when Ginger came to pick me up and to drive me to my hotel, where I was going to testify in a day or so in the biggest psychiatric trial probably of all time, the Kamowitz case, which in which I was the psychiatric expert, and the three-judge panel literally basically said you can't do psychosurgery on people, applied the Nuremberg Code, which I had built up to in my testimony. And it stopped in the early 70s. It stopped all psychosurgery in state facilities. This was in Detroit, in state facilities and in the federal government. And the establishment was afraid to make an appeal. This was a very lower court, for fear that, you know, they'd lose in the Supreme Court. My argument was that psychosurgery destroys the human abilities to have free will, to think, to know, to feel, and therefore was totally destructive of everything about a person, and nobody should be allowed to volunteer for that. No one was ever going to be told that was what was going to happen. And besides, the people who were in these situations were under such coercion that they were more like being in a concentration camp or an extermination camp. That briefly was that case. And I fell so in love with Ginger that I never saw her again. I literally did not see her for 10 years. So it's not your regular love story. And then we met by chance. I feel it was God's hand. 10 years later, we met in another city by chance, and I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. But that didn't end the difficulties, because, you know, why was I so frightened? And what was going on for Ginger as well? And love is very frightening, in part because it re-evokes all the childhood conflicts with our parents, who were supposed to have loved them and may or may not have. It re-evokes all the fears about, can you have what you want out of life? Is it worth risking? I explained that my unconscious was screaming at me right after I met Ginger that if you think you were hurt by the other women, wait till this, and this is the most wonderful one you've ever met, wait and see what you're going to feel like when she rejects you. You know, that was basically the unconscious screaming at me, as best as I can figure out in retrospect. So I ran for my life from what is now the most important relationship in my life. So there's lots of different reasons. I didn't want folks to leave with the idea that this was a silly romantic piece. I mean, the title, Love Can Reformat Our Lives, is very, very deep. But what do you do when you're reformatted? Because then you've got to live in a whole new way and with new values. But I deeply believe in love, as all of you know by now. I believe in all kinds of love, romantic love, love for God, love for nature, love for animals, love for reform work. And I deeply believe that we have the best lives when we overcome our fears and our shames and all of our other negative emotions and decide to engage life in a passionate way. And that's my message. Engage life in a passionate, loving, caring, treasuring fashion, despite how difficult it is. So I wanted to get that little sermonette in, because that is so much, Michael, what I believe, as you know. So I give the mic back to you, sir.
Well, you bring up all kinds of thoughts. It is interesting. I mean, because certainly in the approach to love, it's about the most, certainly in my own life, I remember thinking that was the most difficult thing I've ever did in my life, was proposing to my wife, who I'd already been dating for a very long time, and I was pretty sure I knew the answer. But boy, I wasn't 100% sure. I thought that was really, really difficult. So the essay resonated with me for a lot of reasons. But if I could step aside from the topic of love, I want to get back to the Kamowitz case. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Kamowitz.
Kamowitz.
So there's a lot about it on my website, folks. in that new, you can find a lot of it in that new section. But just go to psychosurgery, just search psychosurgery and you'll get to it. Go ahead.
Well, you're going to find this very interesting. I mean, you know, my field of expertise is Latin literature. So most Latin literature was written about 2,000 years ago, but a significant amount was written about 500 years ago. And I was reading, by accident, a satire that was written in Germany in about, I think, the 1520s, 1530s. So let's call it 500 years ago in Germany. That's right when the Reformation was getting underway. The Reformation is, as you know, when Catholics and Protestants began to split apart, they couldn't agree on the theology. And so someone wrote a satire where they have this heretic, this guy who is he just won't believe in the Catholic doctrines. And so the satire ends with people holding him down, and they bring in a surgeon to open up his brain and cut the heresy out of his brain. Now, I bet that sounds familiar.
That was what I tried to spend 5 years and successfully shut down most of the projects in the United States, and really in the whole world.
Isn't this
cutting the heresy out of your brain? Yeah.
This is it. Amazingly, 500 years ago, everybody, this was presented as self-obviously ludicrous. It was a joke, a satire. People knew that you couldn't cut a heresy out of somebody else's brain by hacking away a piece of it. So sometimes people say, why do you study the past? And I say, well, you know, they say, oh, we moved on so far. I say, yeah, I'm not so sure. In some areas, of course, we've moved on. But in other areas, I'm not sure if we're further ahead than they were in the past. I mean, in our own time, as you talk about in this case, right, people took this proposition very seriously. We're going to cut crime out of somebody's brain. I mean, come on.
It still goes on. There is still that movement going on underneath at all. There are still psychosurgery projects, but they keep a low profile ever since my campaign. It's really interesting to think that my impact from the 70s, which is more years ago than I could calculate, is still there because they don't come out and write a lot of articles about what they're doing anymore. Johns Hopkins has already voiced that they'd like to do psychosurgery, but they have to tell the, quote, Peter Breggins of the world to go to hell. And they said they have to be scientific. I scared them into being scientific.
Wow,
we're going way over on things. But, you know, one of the most important things is that all psychiatric interventions harm the ability to love. So if a lot of our issues are about love, and certainly right on the surface of most people who come for therapy are issues of love, either they're lonely, or their love relationships have gone awry, or they're in mourning, bereavement, or they have terrible clashes with their husbands and wives, or perhaps their children. So most things are about relationship, and if you dig deeply enough into relationship, you'll find that most things are, I think, ultimately about love. And yet all psychiatric interventions, ECT, psychosurgery, most grossly, but all the drugs, in fact, all psychoactive drugs, marijuana, alcohol, they all dull enough of the senses to make it harder to love. And it's something to be very, very aware of in your own life about the effects of drugs. The SSRIs, these antidepressants, I mean, they actually cause sexual dysfunctions. And partly that's just plain physical, and partly I believe it's the blunting of the frontal lobes. And it's a dysfunction of the ability to be passionate and caring. So I'm glad to get around to that before we finish. By the way, today's show, Michael, is the only show I have done since I started taking calls where we have had no callers. And I think it's a tribute to how incredibly interesting you are. The guest numbers have not fallen off. The listeners have gone up some. So it's not disinterest. I think that you've caught, you and maybe me to some extent, we've caught the imagination of people so much that they want to just hear what in the world are we talking about, and not particularly wanting to intervene with questions. I mean, this is very interesting. And maybe some of you will email me at the dedicated email for the show, which is breganlive@hotmail.com, and tell me what your responses were to the show since we're not getting callers. But I'm not really surprised. I mean, I've been so immersed in what we're talking about, what you're sharing. We've only got a few minutes left. I'll be getting a 2-minute or a 1-minute warning soon. What are the thoughts? And we're talking to Michael Fontaine. He's a professor of the classics at Cornell, but he's also involved in other important activities and in relation to the undergraduate body and trying to figure out ways to help people have relationships. Is that fair to say?
That's right. Well, we are trying to do everything we can to increase fairness in education and make sure that students coming from very, very different backgrounds, that we can educate them the best we can. Certainly at the university, we're doing all we can to try and make sure that we can teach them. But the question is, how do you teach people the best? That's not such an easy one to answer. So we're working on all those kinds of questions.
I was thinking you've also been working on something on the loneliness issues and trying to figure out how to help people have relationships, which is really true at all the universities now. Everybody thinks they have relationships, but they're all on Facebook.
This is the real thing. Yeah, we were talking about this the other day, that I read a column. I looked for it for you, and it didn't turn up when I searched on Google a year or two ago, and it moved me very deeply. It said that the average undergraduate student is horribly lonely, doesn't have the kind of friends anywhere near the numbers that I myself had in college, and which, as you say, you know, looks completely different on social media. And so there was a call for university educators, for some of us to consider using our classrooms as an opportunity for students to make friends with one another. I always assumed they were doing that anyway, and that they were all, when class broke up, they would all go off and get a beer or throw a Frisbee or whatever it is they do. And it didn't take long to find out that I was completely wrong about that. So I have been trying to do more activities in my own courses that will introduce students to each other in meaningful ways. So give them difficult questions to come up with an answer to as a group. One example, we have a statue of...
We've only got about 30 seconds, so
I'll
sum it up quick, but it is important. It's about love. It's about relationship. Go ahead.
It is. Well, I had these students do a public art project together involving a statue of Hercules. He couldn't decide whether to take the path of virtue or the path of pleasure, and I put them into different groups of random students to say, what do those words mean, virtue and pleasure? We come from different backgrounds. I want you all to figure it out and come up with your own interpretation, and the answers, Peter, they would blow you away at the commonalities people found. Really quite interesting.
Michael Fontaine, you're an amazing human being, and I love our occasional get-togethers, and I love our occasional get-on-the-shows, and we'll be doing more and more of it, I hope, as we go on with our lives. Folks, thank you for listening. I think this has been an extremely interesting discussion. No big conclusions, just really delving into relationship. Thank you, Michael, for being on, and thank you, my wonderful audience, for listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.